Oh, hey there. I am Guy Branum, back from New York and the island of Curacao.
Did you really go to Curacao?
Oh, yeah.
Yes. Welcome to Pop Rock, a weekly show picking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Good to be back, Winter.
I'm really happy to see you.
Journalist and novelist Margaret Wafler.
Hi there, Guy. It's good to see you again.
It's lovely to see you, Margaret. Margaret is very, very draped in a poncho-y thing today.
Like some Southwest. Are you going to sell me some turquoise after this?
I have many, many bangles for you.
She's bringing drama to the booth. An academic Karen Thompson.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Karen. I feel like Oliver always got academic and DJ. You need to have
academic and culinary enthusiast.
Dyke about town.
Dyke about town. I like it.
I was going to call you burrito box maven.
Yeah.
Do we have
the burrito boxer?
Do we have a word for karaoke artist? Do we have a single word?
Not yet. I could be we'll work on it. I have a few phrases that I'll try with you.
I love Dyke About Town. I just don't think I'm allowed to say it. All right. Order in the studio. Order in the studio. Oh, yay. Oh, yay. On this week's Pop Rocket, we're going to be hearing testimony on which legal dramas excite us. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Margaret Wafler. What are you all about this week?
Yes, Judge. I saw I Am Not Your Negro on Sunday. This is the documentary from the Haitian filmmaker Raoul Peck, and it takes James Baldwin's observations on race in America, particularly from an unfinished book of his called Remember This House. Mm. And it basically weaves it with different popular films and news clips. And a lot of it is surrounding the deaths of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Medgar Evers. But it's focused around those three figures, but it weaves into all kinds of facets of American race relations. And the way it uses film is so brilliant. Without spoiling it, I will just never think of Doris Day, for instance, the same way again.
Wow.
She gets called out in a very interesting way.
No!
And, a lot of it is an indictment of a certain kind of fantasy that we have allowed to exist in our televised and film forms that is not anywhere near reality. And so James Baldwin, through Raoul Peck's composition of this film, is basically calling out all the time the ways in which we just decide to look away from things, mm-hmm. to look away mm-hmm. from the mm-hmm. uncomfortable aspects of race relations in this country and just try to indulge in these fantasies all the time, all around us in American life. And it's just such a beautifully composed film. I mean, it really is a piece of art in a way that I haven't seen for a very, very long time in a documentary. I mean, most documentaries, even The 13th that I'd recommended a couple weeks ago, and I love it and still completely recommend it, but it's much more of a traditional, conventional documentary, whereas this just blows something open completely. Uh-huh. And it's just gorgeous, and I recommend everyone go see it. It's also up for an Academy Award, so we'll
Amazing.
See what happens.
And Sam Jackson is the narrator.
Yeah, and it's, that at first, when I was going into the movie, I thought, am I going to get kind of annoyed with him? Is he going to be a little too much? Mm-hmm. And you would not believe, and this is a good thing, you forget that it's him. And that's the best compliment I can give him because he just sinks into the fabric of the film so much and the voice of James Baldwin so much that it's seamless. And really the thing that's also brilliant about the film is that it's bringing in text from the Remember This House book, but it's also using these clips of Baldwin's lectures and never any fiction, but different essays.
Talk show interviews, too.
Yeah, different talk show interviews. And so it's just incredible, all the different documents that it pulls in.
Margaret, talk to me a little bit about the space that we had in, the 60s and 70s for public intellectuals, that we had these guys, going on the Mike Douglas Show or, Merv Griffin and, the Gore Vidal documentary on Netflix was an interesting reminder of the way that we used to have these people who would come and sort of raise the conversation in our television space. Now we have provocateurs. Do we have anyone on the scene right now who who fills that space? And is that because our media has changed?
Well, let me go back to answering a question about who in the 60s was leading that kind of charge. And one of the major clips that they go back to again and again in the movie is Baldwin on the Dick Cavett Show.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know what most white people in this country feel, but I can only include what they feel from the state of their institutions. I don't know if white Christians hate Negroes or not, but I know that we have a Christian church which is white and a Christian church which is black. I know, as Malcolm X once put it, it's the most segregated hour in American life is high noon on Sunday. That says a great deal for me about a Christian nation. It means that I can't afford to trust most white Christians and certainly cannot trust the Christian church. I don't know whether the labor unions and their bosses really hate me. That doesn't matter, but I know I'm not in their unions. I don't know if the real estate lobby is anything against black people, but I know the real estate lobbies keep me in the ghetto. I don't know if the Board of Education hates black people, but I know the textbooks they give my children to read and the schools that we have to go to. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
He did this thing where he brought a guest on. He would talk to the guest. He'd ask really pretty hard-hitting questions. Yeah. And then another guest would come on, and those two guests would talk. And yeah. Everybody would be involved in a kind of loose roundtable. And the guests would challenge each other, and Dick Cavett would challenge them all. And it just seems so much more intellectual and rigorous. And I just don't see that happening on Stephen Colbert's show. I don't see that happening on any of those late night talk shows. All it is celebrity X coming on to promote their movie, followed by celebrity B coming on to promote their movie, and there's no kind of interchange.
Although I will say, first of all, Angela Davis keeps resurfacing in these various venues, but also more recently, my colleague Viet Nguyen, mm-hmm. who won the Pulitzer Prize for his novel The Sympathizer, was just on Seth Meyers' show and talking about refugees. And so I think that there is right now a kind of hankering for that public intellectual who can also speak and connect to a wider audience. And I'm hoping more of my colleagues step up to that and are participants in this dialogue.
All right. Winnie Mitchell, what are you all about this week?
Big Little Lies, which debuted last night on HBO. Nicole Kidman, Reese Witherspoon, Shailene Woodley, Adam Scott. You always need Adam Scott in there. It's based on a book, the same name. It's about three moms who live in Monterey, which Monterey as a character is, Monterey has always been, they get it perfectly. As someone who grew up in NorCal and went to Monterey, like on sleepy weekends with my parents to go to the aquarium, like it's, Monterey is like a haze and a dream, and they really capture it perfectly. But the show is about, there is a murder that occurs that we don't know who's been murdered yet, but there's a lot of foreshadowing and, conversations, interviews happening in the pilot that look ahead at something that happened. So they're all talking about a murder that has happened, but we don't know who's been murdered yet. Because we don't know what the murder is or who was murdered, you're introduced to these characters. Reese Witherspoon is literally, someone said on the Facebook page, and I have to agree, the role she was born to play. Born to play like this uptight, fastidious, like mom who just has to get everything right.
Went to Stanford.
Yeah. Like, and wants to tell everybody how to do their job better. Shailene Woodley is like this mysterious mom. She has a little kid that we don't know if he might be Damien-ish or not. And then Nicole Kidman, who is married to
Alexander Skarsgård.
Oh, God, he is fucking sexy.
Even I think he's a fucking gorgeous
I'll man. Watch anything I forget. He's gorgeous. And we find out later on the episode, spoilers, that she's somewhat an abused wife. But there's just, and Laura Dern. And I just thought it reminded me of Laura Dern, who's like a tech executive and also on all these boards like PayPal and Google. So they're talking about, which I am so excited about, Northern Californian housewives and the women who work in the workforce. Like, there, we've never really ever examined that world, and it exists, and they've always been sort of given like no attention, or they're swept under the rug. And I think now with the attention that is paid to what's going on in Silicon Valley, it is time. This is the type of show that needs to unearth all that desperate housewifery.
I was about to say, this sounds like the Real Housewives of Silicon Valley.
It's amazing. And they do it, the way they do it is so subtle, because down here it's all theatrics. We're all like, we need the best car, the best outfit, the best restaurant. That's not what they're thinking about there. They're totally thinking about the right things. Having the right home, having the right setup in the home life, having the kids go to the right school, making sure they get there on time. But there's always been something under that. And so this is what the show deals with, I believe.
That sounds amazing.
It's amazing.
I can't wait.
Karen, what are you all about this week?
Well, last year we did a Pets episode of Pop Rocket, and it was me and Margaret and Oliver. And there was some vigorous discussion about how there had never been a great cat film ever made. And ladies
I'm
and
sorry,
gents.
Did no one bring up Cat from Outer Space?
I did.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. My apologies.
I totally did. I totally brought up the Cat from Outer Space, but I have to say the film that I saw this weekend completely knocks that out of the water and back into space. It is Keddie, and it's a documentary directed by Seda Torun, who's a Turkish-American filmmaker. And it's about the hundreds of thousands of cats who roam freely in the city of Istanbul. I don't know if any of you have ever had any friends live in Turkey or in Istanbul. If you ever did, you would notice that their Instagram and Facebook feeds were always filled with photos of these amazing cats. And basically, what this film really accomplishes is it tells a story about seven particular street cats. It's not fictionalized. It's a doc. I don't know how they were able to accomplish this rigging where the cinematography could follow the cat on a cat's eye view through doing its own thing. And there are seven different distinct cat personalities, the lover, the thief, the gentleman, etc.
And it's the true story of seven cats who were picked to live in a city together.
Yeah, exactly. The real world flick. But there are a lot of reflections on religiosity about cats knowing God, and that dogs think humans are God, but cats understand that there is such a thing as a God. And all these
as a dog owner, I object.
And there are a lot of these remarkable scenes with these really, you know, the humans of Istanbul speaking really tenderly about how there's no sense of ownership between the cats and the people, and that instead they just kind of live
coexist
in symbiosis together. And it's a gorgeous film all around. The cinematography by the director's husband, Charlie Wubbermann, who's a German cinematographer, is legitimately incredible. And my favorite line from the film, one woman says, "With cats, we humans might regain our fading sense of humor and rekindle our slowly dying joy for life." So see Keddie wherever you can, whenever you can. I think it's only in LA and New York right now, but I think this thing is going to go gangbusters.
Which Keddie's your favorite?
Oh, God, it's so hard to say. I think that it has to be this one, the first cat who is kind of this fierce mama cat who becomes this huntress, like, and some of the humans she knows talks about how she just starts stepping up her like croissant stealing game. Like once she has these kittens, which you see she has in like some back warehouse somewhere. It's just, yeah.
Kittens
totally
feeding on croissants.
Kittens, croissants,
this makes that
the
one
whole
where
thing.
Kevin Spacey turns into a cat look like fucking Bowfinger.
Right?
Bowfinger was good.
It was good.
Karen, I was like, will it make me a bad comedian? Will it make me a bad person? Will you stop being friends with me if I make jokes about the fact that this is what they show at lesbian porn theaters? Like,
that not this at is all. you know, we saw this at the Arclight because of the
lesbian porn theater.
Exactly. Because of the great storm of LA storm of 2017, we had tickets to go see it in Pasadena, but we're like, no, we can't travel that far. Let's go to the Arclight. And we were at the bar having a little cocktail before the show. And, you know, I hear this kind of like butch voice behind me, 2 points of IPA. I turn around, I'm like, they're going to go see Keddie, aren't they?
It's beautiful to be amongst your people.
Yeah.
This week, I'm all about Rick and Morty, which is a Cartoon Network show that's been around forever that my niece just turned me on to. It is about Rick Sanchez, who is a mad scientist who is constantly drunk and has a car that can drive between dimensions and his adventures with his grandson. Basically, I had kind of checked out of adult animation about 8 or 10 years ago.
What was the last thing?
like during the Aqua Teen years, I was like, this is no.
Like, it was just
It was a level
I agree.
Of Mommy, absurdism. Daddy. It was a level of
just
absurdism.
Became depressive.
That I couldn't enjoy it, and I was like, this is not for me. And I just walked away. And the thing about Rick and Morty is it's got jokes. Mm-hmm. And it's also got this sort of like confident sense of sci-fi comedy. Like this very, like the best sci-fi comedies take these very sort of like heightened premises and just look at them in the most sort of like brass tacks way.
Yeah.
Futurama did it very well. Like the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movies or his books did it so well. And it's just nice. Look, it's a boy show. Like it's definitely a boy show. Like it's always like we're on a planet where ice cream machines are like ice cream gets pooped out of butts. Like there's a lot of butts and there's a lot of farting. And I have just never been like a butt humor kind of guy. And it's like
odd.
Definitely giving that to you. I take butts very seriously. But it is just like rapturously good. And it's one of those nice things of just being able to like, I've been doing a lot of binging recently. Like I started a Mary Tyler Moore binge, like when she died. And then that led me
to Rhoda?
No, it led me into a 30 Rock binge.
Oh yeah.
Interesting.
Winter, you need to understand my relationship with Rhoda is so complex.
Why? Did she do something to you?
No, it's just like having,
I found her way more interesting.
Of course.
Yeah.
Having a TV show that was about the Jewess was so exciting to me, but honestly placed so much pressure on the show. And the wonderful thing about that show is it was kind of a mess the whole way through. They couldn't figure out what to do with her.
Sure.
But I liked the reality of that in ways I feel like it does make it the forerunner to shows like Girls that like have to embrace that like, no, there aren't easy answers in this situation.
Right.
All right. You are listening to Pop Rock. We will be right back to talk about legal dramas after this.
Hello, and welcome to Podphone. What type of podcast are you looking for?
You have chosen funny podcasts about bad movies.
Rated R. May we recommend The Flophouse.
Three friends talk about bad movies and make each other and you laugh.
Rated R. The Flophouse is playing at your ears.
If you download it right now or whenever.
Rated R. To purchase tickets to The Flophouse, you don't need to do that. Just download it. The Flophouse, rated R for nudity, I guess.
Pop Rocket is supported in part by HelloFresh, the meal kit delivery service dedicated to making cooking fun, easy, and convenient. I got a HelloFresh case, and it had like three really cool, healthy meals that were like easy to make and very, very fun. Every week, HelloFresh creates new delicious recipes with step-by-step instructions designed to take about 30 minutes for everyone from novices to seasoned home cooks short on time. They source the freshest ingredients measured to the exact quantities you need, so there's no food waste. They employ a full-time registered dietitian on staff who reviews each recipe to ensure it's nutritionally balanced. All delivered to your doorstep in a special insulated box for free. For $35 off your first week of deliveries, visit HelloFresh.com and enter the promo code ROCKET35 when you subscribe. Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Tongson.
Before we get into our discussion of legal dramas, I have something very important to discuss. The Oscars, or as I prefer to think of them, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Awards of Merit, are coming up. I know there are a lot of listeners who might not be attending a viewing party. That's okay. We are trying to get sassy gays and ladies to the Midwest as much as possible to have those things be an option, but you may be living somewhere distant. And it's important that everyone have somewhere to turn to complain about the opening number or share those difficult moments when Anne Hathaway decides to make everything about her. You know, when you realize that, yes, someone on stage really did just make a joke about how there's always an Asian accountant into a microphone. Karen,
because you said Asian accountant, you asked me, but okay.
Is there somewhere where our listeners could turn if they wanted to have a virtual viewing party experience?
Well, there is a wondrous and special place that our very own Winter Mitchell called a hug box for snowflakes.
Absolutely.
And that is our very own Pop Rocket Facebook group page.
Woo-woo! So, we had a lot of ads this week. Did you notice that, folks?
Yeah,
yes, we did.
People wanted to come on
60
in.
People, I felt like.
Yeah, so come on in, talk about the dresses, talk about the Asian accountants, the crappy music, the people who are being played off the stage. And if you get bored with that, start a conversation about chicken wings or nuggets or something like that. In any case, do join us, and anyone and everyone can jump in and be a part of the fun, and we're often there ourselves.
Yes, 100%.
Yes, we love to have you there, and please live tweet as much as possible, at Pop Rocket Us. We need to be... active in social mediaing while our betters are awarding themselves for having careers.
I will say this, for the first time ever since I've been in Los Angeles, I won't be here for him. And I don't even give a shit.
Where are you going to be?
I'm going to be in New York. But I'm going to, like, totally just park myself there.
In front of a...
Yeah, I have tickets to the Comedy Cellar at 9, so I have enough time to watch the show.
So this week, CBS debuted a new show. It's a spinoff from The Good Wife called The Good Fight. It is like uniquely placed on CBS All Access. So what's the story with that, Margaret?
It's their first show that they're offering All Access. So basically, if you pay, what is it, $5.99 or something like that, you can get on and watch the whole season at once. So it's their bid to try to compete against,
like,
the
Hulu's.
There are
only two episodes of this thing, though. So you, so
right
they,
now.
They, yeah, right
but
now.
But eventually they'll load they'll up have the all whole of thing, them, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think it's their attempt to be a kind of Hulu or Amazon kind of experience.
I like the idea of putting two up. That's really smart. And just give people, like, a taste of what you were trying to do in the first, in the pilot, and then what you actually were able to actually accomplish in
also,
the second episode.
Take your streaming service seriously. For such a long time, the networks have been seeing it, like, such a begrudging relationship with it, failing to understand the way that people have changed their TV viewing habits. It was a lovely period of time when Hulu was that place we could go to for reruns and everything like that, and so many networks were participatory, and they've been pulling out as they think we want to live in this world where we all have, like, 19 apps on our... on our Apple TV. Karen, is that an appealing world to you, or?
Well, look, no, it's not appealing to me because those apps are often, I find, dysfunctional in many respects. I do have to say that Winter is absolutely right. These two episodes completely sucked me into The Good Fight. Even though, again, kind of like I was with the Grammys, I was like, oh, I don't know, should I watch this for Pop Rocket? Blah, blah, blah. And then suddenly I was just like, oh, I really need to know what Christine Baranski's going to do next. What's she going to do now that she's been ripped off by this Bernie Madoff-esque Ponzi scheme? She's going to bring her picture of her with Hillary to the new office, you know? There's going to be a lot of, you know, ladies drinking scotch. And, you know, and I also really love the opening title sequence, which is just a bunch of really fancy lady objet on a black background blowing up dramatically to, like, string music. And I think that the show really kind of sucks us in. Also, I have to say, there is a lesbian character played by Rose Leslie, who's a lawyer.
I love her.
Who just passes the bar. And she, her parents happen to be the ones who are embroiled in this particular Ponzi scheme. Anyway, I'm super curious about it because it is, it's kind of a show about what these powerful white women are going to do now that Hillary lost, basically. Because it's kind of, that's kind of the frame. It opens on Inauguration Day and all hell breaks loose in their personal lives and in their professional lives, just as all hell is breaking loose nationally. So it's kind of interesting.
I love that. That's great.
I watched the premiere, too, and jumping off of what you're saying about it being a show about what white women are going to do now that Trump has won, one of the interesting things that I first got interested in the show, I mean, I watched the first episode, but it was kind of like, when is this really going to get going and take a different turn from most legal dramas?
Oh, yeah.
And I think where it starts to get interesting is when you see the two main characters, Rose Leslie and Christine
Baranski,
basically on the wrong side of a police discrimination case. Mm-hmm. And you see them both, like, really not being very comfortable with being on that side.
Yeah.
And they are arguing against this pretty much all-black firm. And it's set in Chicago. And you see them just really grappling, especially the younger one, Rose Leslie, with, like, why are we doing this? Like, are we really on the right side of this thing? And through many, many different turns in the plot in that first episode, you see them eventually change sides without giving too much away.
Yeah.
I do have a problem with the extent to which our legal, like our dramatizations of legal things do tend to put our heroes on the right side of things. And I understand that that's how you want things to work, but also the law doesn't work like that.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also a way that having, like, it is also important to our system that everyone be well represented. And I would say probably the best way that that is sort of represented is like situations where somebody is representing somebody going to death row or something like that, and they're having to like stand up for a person who is kind of a monster in some way. We sort of explore that, but you know, we don't look at it in the more sort of like subtle situations of just being the bad guys in Aaron Brockovich or anything like that. Was anyone here a watcher of The Good Wife?
No.
Not really. I mean, semi, half-assedly, yeah.
It, like, so many people have explained to me how amazing it was, that it was, like, a very complex and interesting legal drama that had, like, powerful women's stories in it. And, like, Cola Scola is constantly telling me that I have to watch it, and yet I never do. What legal dramas have people watched? Like, we've all seen enough law. We've all seen days worth of Law and Order, right?
Yes, Law and Order to me is the go-to, and it's so comforting. I would stand for it any day. Although, let's just say it really only counts when Jerry Orbach is on it.
Yes, that's fair.
I mean, once he passes away, and like, oh, yeah. No one cares.
Margaret, what is so satisfying about a Law and Order?
It is so formulaic, and you know, formula can be a great thing in the hands of a show like this because you get to see the cold open with the crime or the discovery of the crime. Then you get like the guys that date and tell you when the person died and, you know, whose hairs they had underneath their fingernails and whatever else. And then it leads you through the whole process, basically. Then you get the detectives and you get them interviewing suspects and witnesses and things like that. And then it gets turned over to the lawyers, and they have to prosecute the trial. And so it just takes you through the whole process in a very orderly fashion that's really pleasing. You always know what you're going to get. It's also like they did a good job of ripping things from the headlines, as they used to say. Like, you know, I just watched an episode earlier today to just remind myself of the show, and they had a show about actually, it was a lesbian relationship, and one of them got murdered, and the other one couldn't take custody of the child because of the current laws at the time in Florida.
What a beautiful reflection of that lesbian dog death case in California that forced us to ask the question, who is first friend of the deceased? Is it really still her mom? The thing I love about Law & Order is that they give you one-third of a character development. Like, there's just so little space for the characters to be anything but good at their job. Watching, like, a day of it on a TNT marathon, you would, like, see Mariska Hargitay, like, develop a bit. And not that much. But, like,
well, and the only thing you, like, knew about Jerry Orbach's character besides him at his job was that he used to be an alcoholic. And
right.
That's, like, all you need to know.
And the thing is that it always benefits from, like, the salaciousness of crime. And it is very hard for shows to be about civil law in a way that is interesting in the same way. And one of the things I always loved about Ally McBeal was it did, like, it was very early on in the process of giving you civil cases that felt interesting and a little bit sexy. And it did do those sort of like gay things and trans things before we were really talking about them and talking about employment discrimination or like access to services and stuff. And it would always be done in this kind of glib and silly way, but it was good for the 90s.
I have no memory of them actually ever doing legal things. I remember Vonda Shepard singing songs. I remember dancing babies. I vaguely remember the you know, bathroom that everyone shares.
Yeah, so much happened down
that
bathroom.
That show was, you know, secretly really good at the law. It was one of what's his name?
David E. Kelly.
David E. Kelly was like one of those lawyers wasting their skills on television, as am I. And he did a really good job of throwing in things. That's where I learned about selective enforcement and stuff like that. Like, it was a show that was incidentally savvy about the law, but really just used the law as an excuse to have like a wacky character show up. Let us never forget. That's where we got Lucy Liu and Portia de Rossi in the same goddamn episode. It was
what wow. a pageant of riches. Speaking of David E. Kelly, another show of his I watched was The Practice. Did anybody watch that?
I never watched. Was it Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney? Dylan McDermott.
Dylan
right?
McDermott. Yeah. And I think I solely started watching it because Laura Flynn Boyle was on it, and I was such a Twin Peaks fan at that point that I would just watch anything she was on. She was rarely on anything. That show got gutted, weirdly, in the final season. But, you know, Cameron Manheim was one of the characters on there who was a great lawyer character who, to me, like, the way she even looked with, like, this long hair and these kind of, like, funky earrings and you know, she was overweight and kind of, like, a real person. And she there's something about her just that told you, she was not the sexy lawyer prototype. And I feel like that's what lawyers actually look like usually and feel like and carry themselves like. I mean, you knew just by those funky earrings alone, she had some wild stuff going on.
Winter, what are your favorite legal TV shows?
I haven't really seen many. So, I mean, legal TV shows, not dramas. I mean, Night Court.
Yeah.
I mean, Night Court was funny to me because.
It was so good. Yeah.
I mean, I've talked about my love for Night Court in the past. My only experience with court is going transactionally. I ran a stoplight. I didn't pay my ticket.
That's what made Night Court
felt
great.
Yeah,
because the real work of the law is not having a brand new issue that's never been litigated before every day.
Yeah.
It is like we've got two new prostitutes and a family who fought with each other.
And but that's what made it funny because the way they deal with everything across the board was just how quickly can we get to recess, and that's. Honestly, what Los Angeles traffic court is like, my experience has been. I've never been there and they've like thrown the book at me.
Another surprisingly good legal show comedy was The Grindr on on
with Rob Lowe.
Yes, which
Fred
only lasted
Savage.
For a season, but it was always like a very, very small thing. And that made it so much more possible to go through what actually does go into a case and what the issues actually are, because like most cases aren't things that are like litigated over the course of 3 weeks. They are things that like if it goes to court, it is for half of a day, and usually things don't go to court. If you know what you're doing, things shouldn't go to court.
But I want to say the only reason that I don't really watch legal dramas is one, because it's an hour, and if you start that's what I like about Law and Order, you can start in the middle of anywhere and you're like, I'm good. I get
because
it.
Because of that formula.
Yeah, because of that formula. That's a perfect show. But the legal dramas, you literally have to start from the beginning. You can't, like, I jumped out of How to Get Away with Murder, like, half a season of the first season. I don't know. Somebody died. I was like, wow, somebody died. But the other reason is because true crime is, I just like stuff that I can actually go into the internet and look at. This happened. That's why People vs. OJ was so great.
Well, and also a show that was able to go into the process so much more because there was actual process there, and everything was sort of like so campy and big and scandalous that you could pay attention
and
to
it. And real, though.
Yes. Yeah. You could pay attention to it, where I think if we talked about voir dire for an episode of The Practice, who would give a shit? Karen, what is your...
I don't even know what you just said.
All I have to say is that legal dramas, legal shows seem to be something that I would or should like or be kind of interested in. It's, you know, but it's really a holdover from my parents. I mean, I have memories of them watching The Paper Chase with John Houseman when I was a kid, you know, and it was, and, you know, I never really stuck to or gravitated to any kind of legal drama or program. An occasional legal film, a little Legal Eagles here, a little Kramer versus Kramer there, and of course, good old Atticus Finch in, you know, To Kill a Mockingbird. But I just never became super captivated by the, you know, seeing the process and that kind of drama. I'm much more drawn, perhaps because of my hypochondriacal side, to medical stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, and that those are the kinds of procedurals that interest me. So I think that it you know, it's always a strange thing. I always enjoy characters who are lawyers and who have dilemmas morally as lawyers and the human drama of that. But, Yeah, I'm.
Well, you would have enjoyed L.A. Law.
Of course. Okay. L.A. Law. My folks watch that.
Yeah.
I did
a Wikipedia read through one day for some reason because I was thinking about Amanda Harry Donahoe. Hammond. No, I was thinking about Susan Day, then Amanda Donahoe for some reason. But then I was just thinking, like, they actively, it was a Stephen J. Cannell show, right?
Yeah.
And so it was the way they. I think that's cool. Now, that was a cool show. I remember it, but from, like, as a child's mind, not fully understanding.
The thing is I'm older than you, but it was still, like, a thing where it was after my bedtime on Thursdays,
exactly.
I believe. But I was, like, excited to get to see some of it.
At least the opening credits.
The opening credits were so great, and there was a horriness to the issues that they dealt with.
Yes.
That was really high level, and, like, it was... In the 1980s, children listening, in the 1980s, we managed to create a mythos of Los Angeles that had not existed before. There had been Hollywood before that, but in Los Angeles, or in the 1980s, we really were like, guys.
Please go into it. I wanted to hear.
Teal and turquoise work together. Men can wear white suits, but in a different way than they wear white suits in Miami. Mm-hmm. And Corbin Burnson was a lightning rod for that. And you had like. Such. What's interesting is that I barely watched that show.
Me too.
But the characters that
were so pronounced
he represented, or the Jew and the tall lady who are married to each other in real life,
or Susan Day being like a full on alcoholic.
Yes, and you
Harry Hamlin's hair. People.
Yes. There
was a really nice balance of these are the legal issues we're dealing with, and these are our private soap operas. And sort of a sense of, like, varieties of approaches. Though they did have a dude playing a developmentally disabled character on that show who I remember finding very disturbing as a young child.
I did too.
But it was splashy. Mm-hmm. Like, I want a level of splashiness from... I want earnest, self-righteous legal movies. And I want legal TV shows that are, you know... splashy, selling it.
So then was Law and Order not splashy? I mean, it's not splashy. So did that always turn you off about it?
No. I mean, fundamentally, it's a crime show, but also the crime is the splashiness.
Yeah.
I mean, like, the crime really is like, this woman homeschools her child and what must be wrong with her?
Well, I think so much of what legal shows, the good ones, capture is how much of our lives are lived in compromise. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the fact that there can be a person going through a trial that has a complete right to be, you know, decided that they're innocent or whatever, and then they are charged with guilt, or they have to take a plea bargain, or like all these millions of compromises and just falsehoods you have to accept in the legal system.
Yeah.
I feel like that's the kind of thing that Law and Order and other legal shows will show so well.
Well, and it is that terrifying thing of there, but for the grace of God, it is, you know, it's like 3 years of law school, and the thing I mainly took away from it is every time I get into a car, I'm only narrowly not manslaughtering someone. And if I manslaughter someone, then I go away for 15 to 20 years. And
are you sure?
If you have the right fancy lawyer.
Now I'm scared.
No, that chick from Melrose Place killed 2 people and was out in 3.
Well, I want to get her lawyer. on that subject, if you yourself were on trial for murder... which TV lawyer would you want representing you?
TV lawyer? I have to really...
I'm not going to actually pick someone who's a real lawyer who was depicted on TV. Can I do that?
Yes.
Sean Catt.
Okay. That's the woman from...
She was Johnny Cochran's protege.
Yeah.
And she was on the O.J. Simpson trial, and she's Lindsay Lohan's lawyer, and she just got Tyga out of paying, like, back rent, and she's a good friend of mine, and I love the shit out of her, but that woman is a bulldog, and she is a killer attorney. I would get her for everything.
I would like to offer the name of Claire Hicks Huxtable. I forget whether we ever saw her. I think, like, once we saw her in court. I know I remember one time distinctly seeing her in her offices and being like, that is what a law office looks like. I could do that. But, okay, here's one of the great tragedies of our internet age. If you go on YouTube and are like... a Julia Sugarbaker rants, you'll find them all. They're just there waiting for you, okay?
Yeah.
I have spent so many afternoons at jobs I was not responsibly doing looking for Claire Huxtable and let the record show speeches, which we all remember happening.
Oh, yeah.
She could wag a finger like no one's business.
And they're just not on YouTube. And I have a real question of why are you failing me, America? Margaret, who do you think you would go to for a TV lawyer?
Oh, God. I mean, only because it's fresh in my mind, but I think Christine Bernanski looked like she could really tear something up
totally,
in the courtroom.
Yeah. I mean, I would go with Christine Bernanski, too, or Dylan McDermott or Dermot Mulroney. I'm still not sure who was in the practice.
Dermot Mulroney has never played an attorney.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I mean, but, you know, I would have to reach way deep back to, like, a really good movie, and I would have to have Gregory Peck as Atticus Finch defending me because he could make this monster into a human, right? You know?
Wait, can we use movie lawyers?
All right, sure. Yes.
Because I wanted to talk about The Accused.
Okay, let's talk about The Accused.
Yeah, and Kelly McGillis, I would have her defend me. Because I think she, I mean, for one thing, just an icy blonde defending me in the courtroom. I just see it. I don't know why. But I also just feel like that is a brilliant movie that shows, for one thing, what happens outside of the courtroom that makes so much of a difference to what goes on inside, especially in something like a rape case where you have the criminals themselves like running free and still able to intimidate the victim.
Yeah.
So at any rate, like, I just feel like that movie I didn't see until I was maybe in my 20s or something like that. And I saw it from a film history perspective of like, here is a super prolonged rape scene that doesn't turn away from it. And I think that it's actually a rape scene that should be like studied by the Game of Thrones guys so that they can realize that this is how it actually happens and not this kind of ridiculous on furs kind of bullshit that they always show.
Still not watching that show.
Karen, do you have anything you want to say about The Accused?
Oh, my. No, I mean, when you mentioned The Accused, you know, like, I did gasp a little bit because it was such an affecting film when I saw it. And, you know, and as you're saying, the kind of brutality of the rape, of the sexual assault, of the violence that was represented in that was just something that really stuck with me. I saw it as a teenager and, like, you know, seeing this thing happen at the bar, seeing the forms of slut shaming that were brought into the courtroom. I mean, it is a kind of an feminist consciousness text for me, at least in my kind of age demo. So,
well, it also, that thing I was half talking about and failing talking about of this construction of the female lawyer as figure of power, that movie problematizes it so well because the whole time Kelly McGillis is wondering, how much does this suit protect me from being that creature?
Yeah.
And like both the empathy and the distancing that takes place between her and Jodie Foster is truly wonderful. In my law and literature class, one of the things we talked about was the idea of role norming and positioning yourself through the role that you occupy and not your personhood. And it is this thing of like pretending to be a figure of the law so you don't have to be a woman anymore and have sort of like the negative things that go along with it. And that character sort of like going on a journey of figuring out how to sort of like reconcile those things and be a human being and like an official.
Yeah. And really, I mean the more enlightened version of Kelly McGillis I'd want defending.
Oh, yeah.
And not the version that's ashamed in essence. And that movie has so many layers because Kelly McGillis was herself raped and didn't want to play the Jodie Foster part at first because she didn't think she could handle reliving that experience.
What's the legal TV show or movie you want to see that you haven't seen?
Oh, great question, guys.
I will give you guys time to think while I give an answer of my own. It is a good movie about Ginsburg in the 70s and her work like for the ACLU Women's Rights Project and like this very organized process. They actually wrote like Ruth Bader Ginsburg's husband's nephew wrote a script that was on the blacklist a couple of years ago about it. Marielle Heller, who directed Diary of a Young Girl, she was supposed to direct it and then it fell apart, which didn't make me the saddest because the script wasn't the best. But it is just such like a fascinating, like, civil rightsy story that people don't know that much about and is an interesting human story as well. And so that. Anyone else?
You really have a hard-on for Ginsburg.
I have a hard-on for Ginsburg. That's hardly surprising.
I can totally see a dramatization of a couple of things. I would love to see dramatization of just basically anything that happened majorly in the 80s. So, like, Ted Bundy, like, you know, watching... I would love to see tapes of that trial, but I would love to see, like, Richard Ramirez. I would love to see just, like, people revisit, like, you know, we've seen the Menendez because we got that cable news. We got the CNN version, the court TV version of a lot of these things. But anything that was pre, like, the OJ mania, like, when these things were happening in mass, and we were just getting, like, court sketches and, like,
radio
reports.
We really need a great Night Stalker film.
We need a great night. We've discussed this.
Yeah.
Do you listen to My Favorite Murder?
No, but I should.
You really should.
I know.
It's very good.
Karen, I'll start tonight.
Karen or Margaret, any pitches for legal dramas or...
I'll keep mine really simple and succinct. I will go back to watching The Good Wife, and I'll see what all the fuss is all about.
Oh. All right. That's how nice of you. That's fair. Mm. I'll do the same. We'll come back together. We'll regroup in a couple of weeks.
I love Juliana Margulies. I owe it to her.
I need to have watched it.
I'm going to say something really wonky, and I just want to see a movie where they show the Supreme Court talking about how corporations became people. Like, I just want to know that whole argument and to see it, you know, dramatized, as particularly Scalia being the ridiculous person that he is.
That's very interesting. We haven't really gotten a good Supreme Court movie. They made a
First Monday in October was cute.
Karen, get out of my brain! First Monday in October was a weird rom-com that happened just before, just after...
just before Sandra Day O'Connor.
Sandra Day O'Connor joined the court, and it was this thing of, like, a woman on the court? Well, clearly two of them are going to fall in love. So we asked the Pop Rocket Twitter followers what their favorite courtroom scene was from film or TV. We got a number of responses. Colleen S. said Omar testifying against Byrne on The Wire, one of the best TV scenes of all time. We have Snack said pretty much all of The People versus O.J. Simpson. Also, Silicon Valley when T.J. Miller defended his own company by being too dumb to live. I believe that was a binding arbitration scene, and it made me love it more. Josie Smitty, Marissa Tomei, and My Cousin Vinny. It's one of the great courtroom scenes of all time. Like,
absolutely.
And just the amount that they managed to pull out of her not answering the question, like, it almost brings you to the point of being angry at the movie for, like, no, she would just say it by now. But the thing is they've built up to that point in time just how difficult Mona Lisa is. that by the time it comes to it, it's a beautiful scene. And at The Not Doctor, pretty much all of James Spader's closing arguments in Boston Legal and this scene.
You mean lesbians? Where are you? Today they're calling Tracy to testify that her ex-lover was...
Lesbian ex-lover.
To testify that Tracy was scamming her for money. Tracy was, in fact, not an actual bona fide...
Lesbian.
You like saying it.
I do.
Say it again.
Lesbian.
Keep going.
Lesbian.
All together now. Lesbian.
You're listening to Pop Rocket. We will be right back after this.
I'm Allegra Ringo.
And I'm Renee Colbert. And we host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog?
Renee, can I tell you about a dog I met this week?
I wish that you would. In turn, though, can I tell you about a dog hero?
May I tell you about a dog breed in a segment I like to call Mutt Minute?
I would love that. Could we maybe talk about some dog tech?
Could we have some cool guests on, like Lin-Manuel Miranda, Nicole Byer, and Ann Wheaton?
I mean... yeah, absolutely.
I'm in.
You're on board. What do you say we do all of this and put it into a podcast?
Yeah, okay.
You think? Perfect. Should we call it, like, I don't know, Can I Pet Your Dog?
Sure.
All right. What do you say we put it on every Tuesday on Maximum Fun?
Or on iTunes. Sounds good to me.
Meeting's over.
I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
And Karen Tongson.
Every week on Pop Rocket, we ask our panel, what is your current jam? Karen Tongson, what is your current jam?
So, I heard this on the radio. It's a brand new, fresh hit from the Norwegian DJ Kygo, who people apparently mispronounce as Kygo. But
What?
Yeah, it's Kygo. That is the proper Norse pronunciation of his name. And it's his new hit with Selena Gomez called It Ain't Me. And I'm going to do something a little different and just kind of play a couple different sections of it, because part of what drew me to it was how differently textured the song was throughout. So let's come in sort of at the beginning, near the beginning.
I had a dream, we were sipping whiskey neat, highest floor of the Bowery, and I was high enough. Somewhere along the lines, we stopped seeing eye to eye.
Okay, so that seems like your kind of typical, poppy tune, maybe somebody like Echo Smith would put that song out. But then you get to this other section that kind of shouts like a Fun chorus, the band Fun. Wait for it. And suddenly it gets all weirdo Euro DJ and
like
shit
it.
Like that.
It got a lot more interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it gets really interesting. Because I was at first I was okay, this is a pleasant enough pop tune. But then it starts to the Euro drug taking DJ type stuff. And it's and I was I love all the different aspects and sections of this. It kind of reminds me of the, I hate to say it, the Macklemore song that Guy loved so much, which had so many disparate parts to it. And I was I'm glad it wasn't just a kind of melodic kind of power anthem, and that it does this weird, wacky stuff in the way that What Do You Mean, Bieber's What Do You Mean did.
Yeah.
So I really like it. It's a fun jam.
You know, when Selena Gomez was singing that she would dream about sipping whiskey neat,
I know.
I was you would maybe dream about that, but you've never done that. Yeah,
lay you flat on your back.
I dream about drinking whiskey neat with Selena Gomez. Anyway.
Margaret Wampler, do you have yourself a jam?
I do indeed. I have a song, Tearjerker, by Jarvis Cocker and Chili Gonzalez. It's from their upcoming collaboration, Room 29. It's a concept album based on the same room at the Hollywood celebrity haunt, Chateau Marmont. You guys maybe have heard of it.
The Chateau.
Oh!
Yeah, it's my
Chateau.
Haunt. Yeah, Winter Lounge is there every day. So it's a really interesting chilly. I mean, I say chilly not just because Chili Gonzalez is on there, but it's just a very cold piano, spooky kind of song.
You are a tearjerker. You don't need a girlfriend. You need a social worker. She's waiting at the airport. You're in your hotel room.
Emo Serge Gainsbourg.
Yeah. I mean, Jarvis Cocker writes great lyrics, and that's one of the things that attracted me to the song is just the way it opens.
Margaret, how do you feel about us, solemnizing the Chateau as, the official space of wealthy sadness? There was that Sofia Coppola movie that was fascinating and wonderful. Do you remember it at all?
Do you know who the people who stay there? I shouldn't even be talking about this. I'm staying out of this conversation. Oh.
Okay. Well, you know, David, my husband used to work there ages ago.
Really?
He has some stories.
I believe.
Which I cannot share on this podcast. But, yeah, it makes perfect sense to me. Because it's sad Hollywood. People live in there for months and years at a time, getting sadder and sadder and living off of room service. And
but
Room 29.
I love it.
I know. Well, that's what also makes it kind of alluring and siren-like. But Room 29 also famously, Howard Hughes stayed in it. Gene Harlow. It's had a lot of old Hollywood types. maybe nearly expire in its room.
The Lenten season is nearly upon us, and that means that carnival is happening in a lot of places in the world.
Oh.
And as we all know so well, a carnival in Port of Spain, Trinidad, is where the greatest, like, the greatest battles of Calypso take place.
Oh,
every
shit.
Year, the king or queen of Calypso is declared.
Is this why you suddenly tweeted that you should just stop your comedy career and become a Calypso king?
Margaret, what happened?
Which I was going to respond, I will be your manager.
Margaret, what happened was, is that I kind of went into a hole of, like learning about Calypso, and then like most like Gen Xer like white people in America, I learned to love Calypso from the Beetlejuice soundtrack.
Oh yeah.
That is fair.
And like one of the jobs of Calypso was to talk shit at the powerful people, but in the most fun way possible. So in like the 80s and 90s, when labor relations were sort of primarily the engine of racial discord in the Caribbean, we got no work for Calypso, no work for Carnival from Lord Kitchener. I mean, that's how I want all political activism to sound, is a good tune you can dance to.
I just want to shout out a good friend who's doing a book on the kind of politics of Calypso and like kind of the history of Calypso and politics, named Shane Fogel. So keep an eye out for his work. It's coming out soon. He's written some really amazing stuff already about Belafonte. So it's V-O-G-E-L.
That sounds very interesting and the sort of thing that I would never imagine I would be interested in. Winner Mitchell, what's your jam?
This song is by The Weeknd, and I had a hard time coming up with a song this week because I've listened to everything 100 times, but then I was like, what have I listened to 200 times? It's this song. And this is, we got to go back to I Can't Feel My Face Gate. Because I can't feel my face.
You mean your controversial ruling that it was about cunnilingus?
It was. If this song is not about masturbation, then I don't know what's going on. Even in this speaking
code to you, maybe.
He's speaking code to me. In this reformation of The Weeknd where he's cut off the pineapple and now he's dating Selena Gomez, the one thing that I love about him is he will not give up this poppy version of like talking about his favorite sexual proclivities. So this song is called I Feel It Coming. Just a simple touch and it can set you free. We don't have to rush when you're alone with me. Do you know what it reminds me of? The way I feel about this song, which is so interesting, is 30 years ago, one of my favorite sex comedies of all time came out, The Woman in Red, and it has an amazing soundtrack with Dionne Warwick and Stevie Wonder, and these are the vibes I'm getting from it, which means that this man is a legend.
You guys have been listening to Pop Rocket, which is hosted by me, Guy Brown. I'm sorry I was gone for so long. I will be here. I'm sorry.
Don't promise them that.
I will be here. I don't have anything to do until the show comes out. With Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Karen Toxin. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to The Plague 3 and Ian Lay for the 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't already, please review us. Get in touch with us on Twitter, you guys. We're at Pop Rocket. We post cool pop culture stuff there daily. Join our Facebook group. The Oscars are this Sunday, February 26th, so come join the conversation in the Facebook group. We're all going to be having a lot of opinions. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producers are Kara Hart and the ephemeral Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.